Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar series. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. A quick intro today, and then to our guest, Ilya Shapiro of the Manhattan Institute and a JPC fellow. The JPC was founded in 1985 to provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policy by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. You can sign up there for our insight and in-context articles and our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. The winter issue of In Focus Quarterly this year was devoted to the awakening of the American Jewish community after the events of October 7th. The spring issue was about Israel's ongoing battle for the security of its people. Both of those, I think, are probably worth revisiting. The summer issue is up now. It's the domestic issue. And the fall issue, called The World We Live In, is coming shortly. Let me warn you, it is not an optimistic issue. But you can also find all of our webinars on our website and binge watch. We appreciate that. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Right now, our most important job is to support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in their defense of the people of Israel, making Hamas and its fellow travelers release the hostages, eliminating the Hamas arsenal, and eliminating the ability of Hamas to rearm and govern again. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, we advocate for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. Today, we're headed for the Supreme Court. I know it sounds a little bit like a 180 from the agenda we've been pursuing, but in some ways, in fact, it isn't. The Supreme Court is part of what defines us as a constitutional republic, and that defines how we see ourselves and how other people see us. The Supreme Court is there to ensure that laws passed are consistent with the Constitution. Each term provides information about the role and limitations of government and the protections for we the people. It is true that parts of our media and political leadership have been working hard to distract the public on the issues of the Supreme Court. Do we need one? How big should it be? Should we packing? Should we get rid of it? Don't be distracted. The real question is, how well did the court respond to the crucial issues that lawmakers and citizens put before it? And for that, we have a great person to answer the question. Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute. Previously, he was executive director and senior lecturer at the Georgetown Center for the Constitution, and before that, a vice president of the Cato Institute and director of Cato's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, and author of one of my very favorite books, the 2020 book, Supreme Disorder, which I had the pleasure of reviewing for In Focus Quarterly. I strongly recommend it. He has written much more than that, of course, and contributed to a variety of academic, popular, and professional publications, including all of the mainstream media that you might think wouldn't want to have him. And he also appeared on the Colbert Report once. I think we should ask him about that. Ilya has testified many times before Congress and state legislatures, and he's filed more than 500 Friend of the Court briefs at the Supreme Court. He lectures on behalf of the Federalist Society, was the inaugural Washington Fellow at the National Review Institute, and has been an adjunct law professor at George Washington University and the University of Mississippi. We should ask him about the commute between those two. He is a former member of the Virginia Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And earlier in his career, and I bring this up because I think it's really important, he was a special assistant and advisor to the multinational force in Iraq on rule of law issues. And as you know, and we know, given Israel's problems in Gaza right now and our problems in Iraq and how those things work, it's comforting to know that people like Ilya Shapiro are advising the U.S. government. And now, Ilya Shapiro, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me again. I love being involved with the JPC. My last book, there's out now out in paperback with a updated edition through the Ketanji Brown Jackson Confirmation. My new book is now available for pre-order, Lawless. I love the cover. I might be biased, but wherever fine books are sold online, you can find it and pre-order it. I'm sure it'll be a bestseller if everyone watching this buys it. But here we're going to focus on, at least during my remarks, about the Supreme Court, what it's done recently, and its role in our politics now and in the presidential campaign. To my consternation, the Supreme Court didn't seem to come up at the debate earlier this week. There was perhaps error for Trump not to insert it, because traditionally judicial nominations and the politics of the Supreme Court are a winning issue for Republicans. But we can talk about that later, and the Harris campaign's plan to blow up the court, and the Biden proposal for term limits and so-called ethics reform and all the rest of it. But before we get into that, let's review what the court did this past year, the term that ended in July, actually. Typically, we talk about late June, but it spilled over, I think, one day into July this year. And we're now less than a month from the start of the next term. So, a good time to take stock. There was a record level of unanimity and heterodox splits until the last few weeks. Ideologically split decisions tend to come at the end of each term because of the number and length of separate opinions. And this term, that was especially true. So the term felt a bit schizophrenic. While President Biden called it an extreme MAGA court, really it's a 3-3-3 court, with Thomas Alito Gorsuch on the right, Sotomayor Kagan Jackson on the left, and Roberts Kavanaugh Barrett in the middle. I think that was coined by Josh Blackman or maybe Sarah Isger. I'll let them hash them out. They're both my friends. But in any event, it's that middle triumvirate that is in command. It joined the conservatives to tighten rules for challenging gerrymanders, invalidate a ban on bump stocks, overturn Chevron deference, which we'll get to, allow cities to break up homeless encampments, and grant presidential immunity for official acts. And that centrist trio joined the liberals to keep Idaho's abortion restrictions blocked, allow the government to collude with tech companies to censor speech, and set aside state laws regulating social media platforms. But there was definitely a conservative tilt overall. More than a third of the cases ended up 6-3, with 11 of 58 opinions on the merits, resulting in partisan splits. The previous year, it was only five. There were also 5-5-4s in different configurations, in four of which the liberal trio held. And that's one of the theme of the court. A lot of commentators or politicians might talk about the conservative bloc or the Roberts Six or something like that. Sheldon Whitehouse uses that term, but really it's what was the Ginsburg Four, now call it the Sotomayor Three. Those are the bloc. And also, nearly half the decisions were unanimous. So maybe it's a bipolar court. And indeed, there's a lot of fluidity. The justices work hard to get it right, and there are different interpretive methods, including differing applications of originalism and textualism. And we see fewer calls for so-called common good constitutionalism, even as the court trims some of the conservative litigation challenges that push the envelope. For the first time since I've been a court watcher, the Fifth Circuit beat the Ninth Circuit for most reversals. It doesn't necessarily mean that the Fifth Circuit is wrong. Again, the court chooses its docket, so it's not an overall judgment, but that's kind of gives you a flavor of what's going on. The Chief Justice wrote the opinions in many of the bigger cases, so it's safe to say that he's regained control of the court after it seems that he lost it, and he was in the majority in all but two cases, one more than Kavanaugh, three more than Barrett. At the other end, the liberal bloc was more in the majority than Thomas and Alito last year. But this year, Sotomayor and Kagan were in the majority only 70% of the time. That's low. And if you take away the unanimous cases and the ones that were nearly unanimous, they're only in the majority 37% of the time. Justice Barrett emerged this term as the least predictable of the centrists. You might have heard or seen some writing about her. In addition to her majority opinion on jawboning, the government tech collusion case, which I'll get to, she debated the use of history and tradition with fellow Trump appointees Gorsuch and Kavanaugh across multiple cases. She also defected from the conservatives in the case about using Sarbanes-Oxley to prosecute January 6th cases when Justice Jackson joined the majority insurrectionists, so-called. And she's done it without alienating her colleagues, showing the same thoughtful grace we all saw at her confirmation hearings. So maybe it's really becoming the Barrett Court. We'll see. The cases I want to briefly discuss before opening up for Q&A, I group into three buckets. The social media cases, the administrative law or bureaucracy cases, and Trump law. So on social media, it was supposed to be a huge term. That was largely a fizzle. So Murthy versus Missouri was going to be the big case. The states and individuals sued executive branch agencies under the First Amendment for pressuring social media platforms to censor and suppress speech on issues like the 2020 election and the COVID pandemic, that whole discussion about disinformation, misinformation, all of that. The Fifth Circuit ultimately affirmed a lower court's injunction against the government for having these meetings and pressuring the tech companies, but the Supreme Court reversed on standing grounds. 6-3, saying that none of the challengers could kind of connect the dots between Facebook or the other platforms censoring them, blocking, shadow banning, all of that stuff, and the government doing something. So just because Facebook might have been in alignment ideologically with the government is not enough. There had to be more of a connection. Now, that was an opinion by Justice Barrett. As I mentioned, Justice Alito, I think, had the better of it in dissent, where he talks about, look, there are thousands of pages in discovery, plenty of smoking guns, plenty of, you know, government officials saying, well, you know, sure would be nice if that kind of disinformation didn't get out. And then the next day, these things would happen, or emails between them. But anyway, no standing was the finding. And then in Moody versus NetChoice, a pair of cases that challenged Florida and Texas laws requiring social media platforms not to discriminate based on viewpoint in their content moderation. The 11th Circuit there blocked the Florida law. The Fifth Circuit allowed the Texas law, so there was a bit of a conflict. And here, the Supreme Court unanimously vacated both of those lower court decisions and said that there cannot be facial challenges. That is, you can challenge things if you're harmed in a particular case, but there's not enough evidence that the laws are unconstitutional in every way that they're used. Some curious writings here. It seemed that perhaps Justice Alito, who wrote a concurrence in the judgment, maybe lost a majority along the way. Justice Kagan, who ended up writing the majority, there was a First Amendment analysis, what lawyers call a kind of a peek at the merits ruling. But what was kind of curious about this, when you combine these two cases that I just mentioned, it's almost like you know, nobody can sue, and that gives more reason for states to regulate. And then, of course, more recently, you had Mark Zuckerberg's revelation that Facebook indeed was pressured. So we'll see what happens to that in a non-COVID context in the future. There was another case, National Rifle Association versus Volo, where the court unanimously ruled for the NRA because there were smoking guns. Government officials saying to insurance companies, don't do business with the NRA or there's going to be regulatory problems. So if that's the sort of thing that has to happen to have standing, very hard to sue the government in these contexts. Moving to administrative law, and this is you know, the rule by the fourth branch, right? Increasingly, Congress doesn't legislate, but more and more the rules, the laws by which we live our daily lives are issued by so-called independent agencies, the bureaucracies. And here, the big news is, first of all, the latest challenge to the CFPB, Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, was turned back. It seems like you know, they've tried to kill that for a decade, and it's not happening via the courts. But in these other two big cases in administrative law, were more positive results for those of us doing battle with the administrative state. First of all, the court ruled 6-3 that the SEC cannot just write the rules, investigate under them, charge people, try them, adjudicate and punish all within the SEC. You have to have a right to a trial by jury. So this affects administrative law judges in the SEC and certain other agencies. Very important case. And then in Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, the court threw out Chevron deference by which courts have been deferring to administrative agency interpretations of their operative statutes. That is, judges for 40 years, rather than determining whether an agency is properly applying the law, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, labor regulations, what have you, courts would just say, well, as long as the interpretation isn't crazy, as long as it's not arbitrary and capricious, we're going to let it go. Well, here the court said, no, it's the duty of courts to interpret the law. And we shouldn't just be deferring to these agencies. That may or may not have significance. Chevron hasn't been used by the Supreme Court in about a decade. Half the lower courts have poo-pooed it. So we'll see how these things are brought. But in theory, this should force, at least at the margins, Congress to legislate rather than just leaving vague statutes to the agencies to write the laws about. Okay, moving to Trump law. As it were. You could teach whole classes. I think some law schools do teach whole classes based on various constitutional, executive branch law, civil litigation, criminal law, through things that that Donald Trump and his business entities are involved in. The first case is kind of tangential to, but an interesting aspect of this, and that involves a January 6th defendant, someone who entered the Capitol on that day and was indicted for, among other things, interfering with an official proceeding. But the law under which he was prosecuted, this is the Fisher case, was from Sarbanes-Oxley, the financial accounting regulation from 20 years ago. And the court here said, by a 6-3 ruling, that Sarbanes-Oxley and this kind of catch-all provision about interfering with official proceedings and concealing records and documents was meant to deal with accounting standards and things like this, not whatever was going on in January 6th. So he still can be prosecuted for lots of things, but not for violating Sarbanes-Oxley. Interestingly, one of the counts with which Donald Trump was charged by Jack Smith in D.C. Had to do with this same provision. Jack Smith reframed the prosecution. There was a new superseding indictment. We'll see how courts deal with that. Then there was the case of Trump versus Anderson about throwing President Trump off the ballot altogether for violating Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which says that those who engage in insurrection, having taken an oath as an officer of the United States, will not be eligible. And this case set the record for the shortest time from this idea being a theory being floated in a law review article to a final ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court. Really remarkable. It's about a year ago, just over a year ago, that two law professors wrote this law review article positing this idea. It was quickly taken up by various state courts, and the main Secretary of State, who threw Trump off the ballot. This particular case came out of the Colorado Supreme Court, which had split 4-3, even though all of the appointees were Democrats on that court. But the Supreme Court here ruled 9-0 in what's called a per curiam opinion, saying that the Constitution makes Congress rather than the states responsible for enforcing Section 3. And Congress hasn't legislated on this. They haven't said how it's to be implemented. We can't have, the Supreme Court said, each state determining how which candidates are eligible for the ballot under this provision. And finally, on the last day of the term, potentially the highest profile case that got all the attention, although the Chevron one was more groundbreaking, I would argue, and probably has longer legs, The issue of whether and to what extent a former president enjoys immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office. This was a 6-3 decision on so-called conventional ideological lines, saying that, well, there's three things. There's when the president is acting within his clear executive capacity, he is absolutely immune. So, for example, if he's naming an ambassador or he's talking to his attorney general, which is relevant to one of Jack Smith's complaints, why he had to reframe that, that is an executive official act and is immune. On the other hand, even Trump's lawyers agree that there are certain private acts for which he is not immune when he's acting in his personal capacity or as a political leader or what have you. So the prototypical shooting someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue, that's presumably a personal act for which he would not be immune. But then there's this kind of gray area where the president is talking to election officials in Georgia. That's one of the allegations against him. Or talking to Mike Pence, who in his capacity as president of the Senate, well, when the president is talking to the legislative branch, that's not exclusively within executive prerogative, so might not be immune. But that's for lower courts to determine. It's actually a pretty narrow decision, leaving to lower courts, both with respect to Trump's current prosecutions, future prosecutions of other presidents, leaves courts to determine on a case by case basis. So that's all I have to say about last term. This coming term, that's starting in 3 weeks, has cases about securities fraud with Facebook misusing users' data, a challenge to a Texas law requiring websites to verify users' age, the FDA blocking vaping products, a restriction on transgender medical treatment for minors, the recovery of proceeds from the sale of Holocaust property. That case is Hungary versus Simon. Anyway, those are so far the big cases on the docket, although the docket is slim thus far. It'll probably double in a couple of weeks when the court has its so-called long conference. So I'll leave it there. Happy to talk about those cases from the last term, further preview next term, or answer whatever other legal constitutional issues might be on your mind.
Great. I feel like I understand a lot more than I did before. And this sort of raises a question, because I think there was a time, and you wrote about this in your current book, Supreme Disorder, that most of us didn't pay that much attention to the Supreme Court. We didn't pay attention to who the justices were. Somehow it's become a much more important thing to us, or at least a much more visible thing. We see a lot more about it in the press. And I think every time they announce a new Supreme Court nominee or suggest that someone retire, we pay more attention. How did that happen? I mean, wasn't there a time when the Supreme Court was just basically looking at laws that Congress passed and not deciding enormous issues that we all think of as political issues? I know that's a big question.
Well, politics has always been a part of the Supreme Court as an institution, whether in consideration of nominations or in cases that come before it, whether with respect to Marbury versus Madison and the scope of judicial review and executive power to commission agents, whether it's the Bank of the United States in the Jacksonian era, the Civil War, Dred Scott, and modern times. So it's not that all of a sudden in the last 10, 20 years, or starting with Robert Bork or starting with Roe v. Wade, the court became a topic of political discussion. What's changed is what we have now is the culmination of several trends where divergent interpretive theories map onto partisan preference at a time when the parties are more ideologically sorted and polarized than they've been since at least the Civil War, if not ever. And so when we're talking about a zero-sum game, because there's a finite number of seats, you have, every time there's a vacancy in one of these precious posts, you go to DEFCON 11. Now in our polarized time, where the left has lost control of the court for the first time in generations, There are attacks on it in ways that are, have resonance with, but are a little different than, say, Richard Nixon in 1968 campaigning against the court and signs saying impeach Earl Warren all over the South with regard to desegregation decisions and things like that. So there's not much new under the sun, but it's the we live in kind of a polarized and toxic and populist political time, and the court is not does not somehow reign above untouched by that.
Although it seems to me that you've made a pretty good case for the fact that this is not a totally left-right court, that there's a lot of places that the justices come together, in groups maybe, but they come together. And so maybe we're a little bit hair trigger for the wrong reasons. I'm not sure. I mean, it seems to, I feel better because when you go through that list of unanimous decisions and how they split, maybe we're not as badly off as we sort of thought we were.
Well, of course we're not. I mean, I wouldn't impugn the motivations of any of the justices. I disagree with some of them on some cases, not on others. But yeah, you hear those headline those last that last couple of weeks. I said that there were 11 cases that were, or 12, depending on how you count, that were 6-3 on so-called ideological lines. Almost all of them came in the last 2 weeks. So because there are going to be those hard cases where there's, judgment calls with ideological salience based on interpretive methods that diverge, as I said. But yeah, for the most part, or not for the, I mean, in general, being a lawyer, being a judge is supposed to be different than being a politician. And it is too much shorthand to talk about the court as being, or certain justices as being conservative or liberal, let
So
alone Republican or Democrat.
I wasn't impugning the justices. I was impugning the politicians who keep saying,
Sure.
this is our court
Sure.
and they should be this or they should be that. I think I'm happy to see that they're not that they're in fact weighing the cases against the Constitution. So to be honest, everybody, I am having trouble with your questions on my computer. So I've got some questions in front of me. If I don't get to yours, I will try to send them to Ilya later. And maybe my computer genius will come in here and fix my problem. But in the meantime, we do have a lot of questions about what happened on campuses over the past year. And you have written a lot about it, and we were pleased to have you in focus. So the first question that we have here is demonstrators waving the flags of US designated terrorist organizations. Hamas is one, Hezbollah is one. Is that a free speech issue? Or if the terrorist organization is designated, why are people allowed to promote them and wave their flags?
Well, you can wear, swastika armbands if you like as you parade down the street. The famous Skokie parade case that the ACLU defended the neo-Nazis in the 70s. The way to look at these things is I wrote a piece for the Free Press, Barry Weiss's publication, back in November. That had a campus focus, where you look at things that you have robust and should have robust speech protections, but certain things aren't speech: assault, vandalism. The best example of this that I came across was somebody urinated on a Hillel and then claimed an expressive exemption for when he was arrested. And like, no, it doesn't matter whether you are vandalizing or beating somebody up with a political agenda or a creative agenda or anything else. That's not speech. Then there are narrow exceptions to protected speech. So true death or rape threats, true threats, or incitement of violence. There's a pretty high bar on all of that, whether you're talking about Supreme Court jurisprudence or what's been transferred in parallel to campuses in terms of what incitement means. It has to be direct, it has to be imminent. There's the difference, for example, between holding a rally and encircling a Hillel and making threats that way. Rules about harassment and hostile environment come into place at that point. And then there are time, place, and manner regulations. So even with core protected speech, political speech, I can't go to your neighborhood in the middle of the night, 2 a.m., and with a bullhorn tell you exactly what I think of Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. That's disturbing the peace. And even though it's core political speech, there are regulations. Blocking traffic, I don't care why you're blocking traffic, whether it's to be to make an artistic piece of art, whether it's to make a political point or anything. You can't do it. Just earlier this week, my friend Ted Frank sued a bunch of organizations and individuals that organized the blockade of roads and highways leading up to O'Hare about a year ago that caused people to miss flights and a whole host of things. Again, you're not going to have a First Amendment defense to that. So, in the context of having these terrorist flags, it just depends on the specific facts. If you're engaging in all sorts of menacing behavior, inciting violence, whatnot, or you're blocking traffic, then what kind of flag you have is beside the point. But if you're like say in the central square, not blocking access to anyone, not harassing someone, not inciting violence, then that sort of thing is protected. But the devil is in the details, and there's also different aspects of looking at it, like who organized it, because it could be that an individual protester is exercising his or her constitutional rights. But if that is organized by a group that has ties to actually does has tie to Hamas or Hezbollah or another designated terrorist organization, then they're providing material support for terrorism, acting as a PR agent or a legal agent for such a group is can and can be and is illegal. So prosecutors are hopefully looking at that in different contexts, but the devil is in the details.
So do you have to sue them, or should police be stopping them? In other words, particularly on the road to the airport, and there were several other blockages that created serious disruption for people. And the
Police,
police, where are the police?
it's not so much the police as the political leaders that are the bosses of the police and telling them what to do and establishing policy. And yeah, in too many places, they've just let that go on. Whether it's blocking bridges in New York or this O'Hare case or certain others, and the police cannot be sued over this. That's why you're seeing private lawsuits against the protest organizers.
Can you sue the government? In other words, I get your point. The police are not independent agents in some ways. They work at the behest of the political leadership. But if
No, you can't sue public officials for bad policy decisions.
for not protecting me, I
Nope.
mean, I don't have a
Nope.
right to be protected.
There are extreme cases going to the Supreme Court about, you do not have the right to any police protection.
Okay, that's important. I didn't know that, and that's I think that's very important, especially for kids who go to college campuses and feel that they are threatened. Then they have the obligation, or someone on their behalf. Can you sue the universities?
Yes. And there have been lots of lawsuits against universities, especially under Title VI, which says that if you're a recipient of federal funds, you have to provide equal access to educational opportunities. And lots of campuses, lots of universities are aware of problems and do nothing. At that point, they become liable. So it's not at that point you can sue those more deeper pockets, bigger institutions, rather than trying to figure out who the student protesters are.
So explain Title VI for our listeners a little bit better. Wasn't it initially designed to ensure that minority students had access? I mean, it's in the racial sense, or in the national origin sense. And it's being applied now to Jewish students. Is that where we're going with?
Yes.
Okay, so.
For it's not a new thing to offer protection to Jewish students in this way, based on the national origin, ethnic background, and other protections that are statutorily in Title VI. The Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education has investigated schools in the past for anti-Semitic things and that's continuing. There's also just breach of contract claims that can be made because every school has a student handbook, and the students have their responsibilities, and the school has its responsibilities, and they breach their contract in various ways.
Okay. So again, we're seeing a lot of the burden for this placed on the individuals who are wronged, or organizations that support those individuals who are wronged, which I think is important. I'm not sure that people understood that in the beginning, that the sort of assumption that your police protect you may not hold exactly like that. Okay, what about moving on? I mean, in the same general area, but moving on slightly. What about the money? It turns out that there is an awful lot of foreign money that has come into American universities and colleges, and some of it comes from countries that are designated terror organiz designated as terrorists, Iran being one of those. Is there some obligation for the university to report that? And again, do you have to sue the university to get the information? I'm trying to figure out how much of this people are going to have to do for themselves as opposed to.
Well, congressional committees have started investigating that, and some of this information has come out through FOIA requests and congressional subpoenas. But yeah, I mean, you can sue the university to get the information, especially public schools. And it's something that needs to be investigated by the Department of Education, by Congress, various federal oversight agencies, Department of Justice. The Attorney General of Virginia, Jason Meares, is investigating, has been investigating the origin of all of these things. But it's no crime to have a campus in Qatar, but there are violations in other ways, as you say, with ties to material support of terror or of these illegal encampments.
So we had, I did get one question from Melissa. Something snuck through what is basically a dead question line. The questioner asks, the fact that an organization is designated a terrorist organization does not matter, or it does matter? Hamas being actually designated.
It does. It
It
does.
does matter.
Yeah,
So
there are statutes against providing material support for terror, and that is defined by whether the State Department has designated it as a terrorist organization,
okay.
or a state for that matter. States have their own designations.
Okay. I've come to a point here, and I'm sorry to do this to you because I'm learning so much, but we're essentially dead here. I don't have questions. I can't read the stuff that I'm supposed to read. So I could just sit here and ask you questions. But
I can see Q&A here on the Zoom.
if you can see Q&A, would you pick a question to answer? Because I can't see it. And the list of questions I came in with, I can't access. So I can sit here, but if you can do the Q&A, that'd be great.
Sure. See the order that came in. Okay. Mark Sachs asks, I've read Supreme Disorder. And that's my book, and Cass Sunstein's How to Interpret the Constitution. I'm amazed by how many judicial philosophies there are. It seems no jurist fits squarely into one. Could you comment on this, and how do we understand the differences? I mean, I don't know what to say about that. It's people are people. These are not robots. It's not just, here's the originalist answer, and there's only one. Originalists disagree amongst themselves. Yeah, I mean, not much more to say about that. There's people are scholars and judges and lawyers that disagree about difficult questions. If the questions were easy, the Supreme Court wouldn't be deciding them. Okay, Anonymous asks, the standing decisions seem rather arbitrary to me. Is standing not a jurisdictional issue that could be defined better by Congress? Yes, standing could be. If it's a statutory case, then standing can be defined by Congress. For constitutional issues, not so much. And there have been a number of standing cases this term and in the past that it's kind of head scratching who gets standing and who doesn't. It's often seen as kind of an out for the court when it wants to avoid opining on one side or another of a controversial issue.
Okay, I got back a couple of questions that came in to me before. In July, President Biden talked about changing the court, adding to the court. Some other people have talked about term limits for the court. Can you talk a little bit about the history of those efforts and how the court got to 9? It hasn't always been 9. And what would happen if we tried to go to 16 or 14 or 137?
Right. My last book, Supreme Disorder, covers all of this in lots of detail for those who are truly curious. The number of justices is not in the Constitution. We've had as many as 10 and as few as six. It's been fixed at 9 since 1869, so over 150 years. So there's a norm, you could say, but it would just take an act of Congress to change that. The period of service, on the other hand, is in the Constitution. The Constitution says that the justices serve on good behavior, meaning unless they're impeached. They can't just be removed. And there's arguments that they can be term limited if, and this goes to the Biden proposal, if their salaries are maintained, they're still called justices, call them senior justices, say, and they sit when somebody on the court is recused, or they can sit in the lower courts, things like that. I don't buy that academic argument because that's changing the nature of the office. Now, if we were writing on tabula rasa from the beginning, would we want term limits? Maybe. I mean, public opinion polls suggest that it would increase confidence in the court if we had, for example, an 18-year limit, which is the most commonly proposed. Why 18? Because that's double nine. So we would have a vacancy every 2 years. Every presidential term would be guaranteed two. But how would it work if, for example, the Senate didn't want to confirm someone that the president didn't appoint and just kept not, rejecting them? Would that seat be held open then until the next president, who would then get three? And would that term still be 18 years, or would it decrease as long as the seat's vacant? So there's an issue with that. Also, how do you get from the current justices to that ultimate term limited situation? Would the current ones be grandfathered in and they would still serve until they die or retire? So we could potentially go up to however many justices as the new president gets, a pick every 2 years, and then eventually the court will go back to nine and they're all term limited, unclear. Or what you would do if you were expanding the court would, again, transition issues make this very, very hard, and ultimately, politically nearly impossible. There have been some compromises floated to fix the court at nine but add term limits. That could be a good political compromise, but though again, I think for term limits you would need a constitutional amendment. So these things, I think that the Biden proposal is really a messaging bill, messaging mechanism, together with an ethics reform, which again sounds good, but what is the exact problem it's trying to solve? Is someone actually saying that because Alito got to go on a nice fishing trip 20 years ago, that's why he voted to overturn Roe v. Wade, or Thomas got a good loan to buy his RV, and that's why he is a strong Second Amendment supporter? It doesn't compute. There are plenty of ticky-tack violations, disclosure violations, whether with Justice Jackson and her husband's income or other things. All of this is kind of throwing smoke at the court to make it look like there's fire, because again, the left-wing activists and politicians don't like the direction of the court. Court earlier this year unanimously put in a new ethics code, but to have it be enforceable by an outside organ would be unconstitutional. Are you going to have lower court judges evaluating the Supreme Court? Are you going to have congressional committees with all the politics that's involved dictating who's recused from a particular case? That seems terrible and would truly delegitimize the court. So that's where we stand.
So it seems to me that doing nothing is the least political thing, because all the examples you've given us are ways that would make the court more political. I have to get my way against the court, and maybe doing nothing is better for us, particularly in light of the way you described the court, the kind of sense of three groups, which I hadn't thought about before, indicates that there's movement inside the court. Maybe we just let it go.
Well, look, you talk about court packing, and this Biden proposal is correctly labeled court packing because, in effect, by putting in term limits and not having a grandfathering, that would cause the three most senior justices, Roberts, Alito, and Thomas, to force them to retire. That's naked court packing right there. When FDR in 1937 proposed court packing, meaning expanding the court by a number of justices that would give him a majority, that was overwhelmingly rejected. Congress hated it. His own vice president campaigned against it. Two justices testified against it, and the Democrats ended up losing 81 seats in the House and 8 in the Senate over it. And this is after Roosevelt had been overwhelmingly reelected in 1936, winning all but two states. Democrats had super majorities in both houses. You know, he was hugely popular, but this court packing was not. But 4 years later, Roosevelt packed the court the old-fashioned way by maintaining political power and kind of waiting for natural attrition. He didn't appoint anybody in his first 5 years on the court, and his next 4 years, he appointed everybody but one. So that's the way to change the court.
So we're coming toward the end of the program. Give us a look forward. Somebody has asked the question, what are some of the issues that could affect American Jews on the court? So civil rights cases, I suppose, can affect Jewish students, and also these cases having to do with universities and security for Jews on campus. Do you see anything coming that would be of particular interest to the Jewish community?
We're going to have more litigation over racial preferences and other DEI-related practices at universities. Not this year. You know, the Harvard affirmative action case was just decided just over a year ago. We're getting the first statistics about the first class admitted afterwards, and it's interesting. You know, some places the racial ethnic mix has really shifted. Some it hasn't. You know, were those schools lying? Are they now violating what the Supreme Court was doing? We'll see what happens with that. These Title VI cases coming out of the post 10/7 demonstrations, encampments, all the other craziness, I imagine most of those will settle in some way. Some already have. I think NYU settled in some way because the schools will not want to have a precedent against them. You know, UCLA had that finding from the district court that they were responsible for, you know, allowing Jewish students from not being able to access parts of campus and things like this. They were going to appeal that ruling and were shamed out of appealing because they got so much bad press for saying, wait, you're saying it's okay that Jewish students aren't able to access campus, or you're not responsible even though you're in control of campus. So these sorts of things may not reach the Supreme Court. But in general, it's hard to predict what kind of, you know, First Amendment cases, whether with online speech or coming out of protests or civil rights cases, either statutory or, you know, equal protection related cases that come out. But, you know, Jews should be interested in general in the rule of law, because historically it's when there's arbitrary rule that Jews have gotten it in the neck.
That's a really good point. So we've come to the conclusion, and at the end of each webinar, I ask our guest to leave us with a positive thought. I should have warned you. Maybe you want to talk about being on the Colbert Report as a positive thought, but can you leave us with a positive thought? Because most of our politics, including Supreme Court politics today, are not positive. What have you got for us?
So in my next book, I detail the breakdown in higher ed with a focus on legal education, because, of course, lawyers, especially those educated at so-called elite schools, are going to be the gatekeepers of our political and legal institutions, our future judges and politicians and general counsels to Fortune 500 companies, managing partners of huge law firms, all the rest of it. And the illiberal takeover here, by which I do mean illiberal, this isn't just kind of the next in a litany of decades old conservative complaints about hippies taking over the faculty lounge at Berkeley, but instead the subversion of the ideals of the rule of law, the idea that law is never objective, that institutions need to be blown up and reformed according to new privilege hierarchies and intersectional matrices and all of this critical theory stuff. That's really dangerous and really worrisome. But we're fighting in the eye of that storm. 10/7 has revealed and elevated a lot of these problems, and the disastrous testimony by the university presidents has further put this issue into the national public discourse. And what we've seen is that it doesn't take that much at the end of the day to change things in the sense that it takes a lot of political will, but these are not complicated policy issues. And so a lot of times, to mix metaphors, these structures are paper tie or Potemkin villages guarded by paper tigers. Naming and shaming does a fair bit, forcing deans and presidents and provosts, who are generally not woke radicals, but instead they're spineless cowards, forcing them to see that the cost-benefit analysis matrix has shifted. And so if you want that next promotion, if you want to be lauded by your peers, just placating the braying mob is not costless, can accomplish things. Heather Gherkin, the dean of Yale, who wants to be the president of Yale or Princeton or Harvard, and when Yale had those scandals a couple of years ago, all of a sudden there's new policies in place. Keith Whittington, who's a big non-progressive free speech proponent, has been hired as a senior faculty member. A former Alito clerk has been hired as a junior faculty member and trying to reform things. That's a microcosm, but it really will take exogenous shocks from employers, state legislators, congressional investigations, judges, you name it, to change these things. But I was asked just yesterday at a panel at a Federalist Society Defending Freedom Institute conference on education policy, give one thing that I would change if I was a dictator for a day. I cheated. I gave two things, and that was simply enforce the policies in place. Most of these schools don't need new policies. What I went through at Georgetown, their speech and expression policy was perfectly fine. It just wasn't enforced. Get rid of the DEI bureaucracies, which in public schools is a lot easier to do. I think 14 states have done some version of it at this point. So we're in the eye of the storm on that, but these are not complicated policy questions.
Okay, I'll take that as half optimistic and half a requirement that we as citizens do our jobs as well, which is also optimistic. Ilya Shapiro, I want to thank you for an enlightening look at where we are and where we might be going and where we've been. And to everybody on, I apologize for the question problem, but please consider buying Supreme Disorder, which you can buy now, and pre-ordering Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites. I think you're going to find an awful lot in there. That will gin us up for the fight to come.
And Shoshana, I'll also mention I have a Substack, Shapiro's
Oh,
Gavel, which
Shapiro's
there's.
Gavel. This is great. Shapiro's Gavel. Do his Substack. It's
So
terrific.
the stuff that I don't put in the Wall Street Journal or Newsweek or City Journal or what have you, I put there, including personal reflections. And my latest thing was a list of potential justices that Trump could consider for the Supreme Court.
Do that, everybody. Substack. Shapiro's Gavel. Thank you for joining us. Ilya, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and we'll have you back, I hope.
Thank you. Take care.